It was American troops from our own SS Brazil who were aboard the train. Sabotage by Vichy French forces was suspected. Apparently our unit, on the highest deck, had been the first to be debarked from the ship and the only one to be sent on to Camp Lucky Strike by road. The entire rest of the ship, several thousand troops, had been loaded throughout the day and the evening onto a train of 40 and 8s, small French baggage cars built to carry either 40 men or 8 horses. It was after midnight before they were all aboard and the slow trip over the disrupted French rail system began. Approaching the nearby station of Street Valerie en Corx, the train was mysteriously switched to a little used sidetrack terminating at the station house. Traveling full speed, the train crashed into the brick wall of the building. I had never seen nor imagined such a scene of carnage. Some of the men had been killed outright, many more were pinned inside the wreckage, crying out for help. We stepped over severed arms and legs, we wrestled with tangled metal keeping us from reaching our shipmates. I found myself assigned to a captain working in an improvised first aid tent. But our medical supplies were not yet unloaded from the ship. For a long time between the doctor and me we had one pair of nurses' bandage scissors, a needle and thread, and a few emergency shots of morphine. It was my first exposure to human suffering on a large scale. I had once thought I wanted to help people in pain. But I had been thinking of natural problems like Papa Dabney and his arthritis. What was facing us today was suffering deliberately inflicted by one group of people on another. If hatred could grow this powerful, for we were preparing to do the same thing to them, who wanted to live in such a world. At the end of the nightmare day, when the last casualty had been sent by ambulance to the nearest hospital, I found myself brooding on the fact that others had been permitted to leave this existence while I was condemned to stay. I had seen fellows my age die that day, and except for their suffering, felt a pang of envy for them. Why had our unit been the only one that was not aboard the train? The question came back to torment me over and over in the weeks that followed. As time after time I found myself a few tenths, a few yards, a few feet away from the leap into his presence we bodily creatures call death. From Camp Lucky Strike, the 123rd Evarc traveled to Rethel, France, 350 miles east, where we could service troops from the combat zones. We set up our tent city, hospital, sleeping quarters, mess, on the grounds of an abandoned chateau. Its tall windows broken and dark, weeds growing in the circular driveway. And there as we cared for the injured and dying, my longing for death became an obsession. I saw the fact of physical survival as a judgment on me, a rejection of me by the person whose love meant everything. I was sitting on a tree stump behind the chateau one afternoon, asking again to be allowed into his presence, when a master sergeant came running through the yard. "On your feet, soldier," he barked. An Air Force sergeant's in C-tent with his knee darn near blown away. Inside C-tent I spotted him right away. An Air Force jacket lay on the footlocker, and when I saw it my whole body went tense. Three stripes above, three stripes below, a diamond in the middle, the guy was not only a sergeant, he was a top sergeant, and every top sergeant I had known was a foul-mouthed, small-minded, bullying. "Hi. My name's Jack Helms. What's yours?" Looking up from the cot through eyes glazed with pain and morphine was a fellow around my own age. He was obviously hurting badly, but when I had told him my name he wanted to know a lot of other things about me, where I was from, what kinds of things I liked to do, did I have brothers and sisters. Talking helped keep his mind off the pain, he said. In spite of myself, as I changed his dressing, I found myself asking him questions, too. He told me he was from El Dorado, Arkansas, that he had been working as a car help in a restaurant there. That morning the jeep he'd been driving had hit a landmine, luckily his had been the only injury. A doctor came in to examine the injury and give me instructions for keeping it clean. When I had done what he told me there was no reason to stay. But I kept hanging around the bed. There was something about Jack, he did not like to be called sergeant, that made you want to be near him. He reminded me of somebody, but I could not think who. He was a big, good-looking fellow with a deeply tanned face and dark brown eyes, but it was his smile that was unforgettable. It split his face from ear to ear and enveloped you and the big green tent and the whole Medivac hospital in a glow of appreciation. I had treated knee injuries before and I knew they kept on being painful. But Jack never mentioned this. He seemed more concerned about my problems than his own. When he heard about the school fiasco, he was on fire with eagerness for me to go back, after the war, and try again. All he would talk about was my great future as a doctor. When I told him about the guy who was going to keep me out of school, he broke into one of his sunburst smiles. People say a lot of things. If my guess is right, he won't even be at that school when you get back. As a medical tech, my job included everything from carrying trays and bedpans to giving shots and running errands to the PX. Like the other techs, I had pretty much been putting in time until my shift was over. Now, to my surprise, I found myself staying late, working extra hours. Who was it Jack reminded me of, and why did I feel so good when I was with him? I was curious. His second day in the hospital, when an Air Force major showed up asking for Sergeant Helms. In the rigid caste systems of the services, officers and enlisted men had little off-duty contact. When I led him to C-Tent, however, the major sat down at the foot of Jack's cot and chatted for half an hour. Jack told me later that this was the officer he had been driving when their jeep hit the mine and overturned. So it's natural that he would feel concerned about me. Already I was discovering that behavior that was natural around Jack was somehow different from ordinary behavior. To me, the most remarkable part of the major's continuing visits was not the greeting Jack gave him, but that he gave the same greeting to anyone who stopped to talk to him, including me. Jack seemed to make no distinction between the major or the surgeon who operated on his knee, and the lowly tech who changed his bedsheets. Within a week, Jack was hobbling about in a cast, and now whenever I was not on duty, we would take a walk together, at first just around the grounds of the chateau, picking our way through the weeds of what had once been a sunken garden, then out along the road that led to Rethel. Ostensibly I was helping a wounded airman make a recovery, but I was aware, and I suspected Jack was. The question came back to torment me over and over in the weeks that followed, as time after time I found myself a few tenths, a few yards, a few feet away from the leap into his presence we bodily creatures call death. From Camp Lucky Strike, the 123rd Evac traveled to Rethel, France, 350 miles east, where we could service troops from the combat zones. We set up our tent city, hospital, sleeping quarters, mess, on the grounds of an abandoned chateau, its tall windows broken and dark, weeds growing in the circular driveway. And there, as we cared for the injured and dying, my longing for death became an obsession. I saw the fact of physical survival as a judgment on me, a rejection of me by the person whose love meant everything. I was sitting on a tree stump behind the chateau one afternoon, asking again to be allowed into his presence, when a master sergeant came running through the yard. "On your feet, soldier," he barked. An Air Force sergeant's in C-Tent with his knee down near blown away. Inside C-Tent I spotted him right away. An Air Force jacket lay on the footlocker, and when I saw it my whole body went tense. Three stripes above, three stripes below, a diamond in the middle, the guy was not only a sergeant, he was a top sergeant, and every top sergeant I had known was a foul-mouthed, small-minded, bullying, "Hi. My name's Jack Helms. What's yours?" Looking up from the cot through eyes glazed with pain and morphine was a fellow around my own age. He was obviously hurting badly, but when I had told him my name he wanted to know a lot of other things about me: where I was from, what kinds of things I liked to do, did I have brothers and sisters. Talking helped keep his mind off the pain, he said. In spite of myself, as I changed his dressing, I found myself asking him questions, too. He told me he was from El Dorado, Arkansas, that he had been working as a carhop in a restaurant there. That morning the jeep he'd been driving had hit a landmine. Luckily his had been the only injury. A doctor came in to examine the injury and give me instructions for keeping it clean. When I had done what he told me, there was no reason to stay, but I kept hanging around the bed. There was something about Jack, he did not like to be called Sergeant, that made you want to be near him. He reminded me of somebody, but I could not think who. He was a big, good-looking fellow with a deeply tanned face and dark brown eyes, but it was his smile that was unforgettable. It split his face from ear to ear and enveloped you and the big green tent and the whole Muddyvark hospital in a glow of appreciation. I had treated knee injuries before and I knew they kept on being painful. But Jack never mentioned this. He seemed more concerned about my problems than his own. When he heard about the school fiasco, he was on fire with eagerness for me to go back, after the war, and try again. All he would talk about was my great future as a doctor. When I told him about the guy who was going to keep me out of school, he broke into one of his sunburst smiles. People say a lot of things. If my guess is right, he won't even be at that school when you get back. As a medical tech, my job included everything from carrying trays and bedpans to giving shots and running errands to the PX. Like the other techs, I had pretty much been putting in time until my shift was over. Now, to my surprise, I found myself staying late, working extra hours. Who was it Jack reminded me of, and why did I feel so good when I was with him? I was curious. His second day in the hospital, when an Air Force major showed up asking for Sergeant Helms. In the rigid caste systems of the services, officers and enlisted men had little off-duty contact. When I led him to see Tent, however, the major sat down at the foot of Jack's cot and chatted for half an hour. Jack told me later that this was the officer he had been driving when their jeep hit the mine and overturned. So it's natural that he would feel concerned about me. Already I was discovering that behavior that was natural around Jack was somehow different from ordinary behavior. To me, the most remarkable part of the major's continuing visits was not the greeting Jack gave him, but that he gave the same greeting to anyone who stopped to talk to him, including me. Jack seemed to make no distinction between the major or the surgeon who operated on his knee, and the lowly tech who changed his bedsheets. Within a week, Jack was hobbling about in a cast, and now whenever I was not on duty, we would take a walk together, at first just around the grounds of the chateau, picking our way through the weeds of what had once been a sunken garden, then out along the road that led to Rethel. Ostensibly I was helping a wounded airman make a recovery, but I was aware, and I suspected Jack was, too, that the greater healing was taking place in me. We talked about everything on those walks, school, childhood, careers, and all the time the feeling grew that I had known Jack Helms before. He was a deeply committed Christian, I learned, a Protestant, although he attended church with the Catholic family who had adopted him and shown him great kindness. And all at once one day, without intending to any more than I had intended talking to my stepmother, I found myself telling him about the night I had come out of a hospital movie theater and asked a ward boy for some aspirin. As they had been the earlier time, the words were simply there. I told him all of it, the ambulance ride to the X-ray section, waking up in a strange small room to find someone else in my bed, walking down a street in Vicksburg, Mississippi, trying to get a passerby to listen to me. It was the second time I had been able to talk about my experience. I could tell by the wonderment in Jack's face that he had never heard anything even remotely like what I was describing. I could also see by his expression that not for an instant did he doubt what I was saying. I described the light that had entered the little cubicle. How my whole life had somehow entered at the same time, lit up by a love such as I had never. I stopped, staring at Jack. That nagging feeling that I had known him before. That strange sense I had had the very first day of being in the presence of a familiar friend. It was Christ who all this time had been looking at me out of Jack Helms's eyes. The acceptance. The caring. The joy. Of course I recognized these things. I had encountered them in a hospital room in Texas, and now, 5,000 miles away, I had met them again on a hillside in France. They were echoes only, this time, imperfect, transmitted through a fallible human being. But at least I knew now from whom the message was coming. So much was falling into place as we turned around on the road and headed back toward camp. For once neither of us spoke. Jack did not press me to continue my interrupted story, he seemed in his perceptive way to know that I was working something out in my mind. The lonesomeness I had felt that year, the alienation from the world and the things that went on here, wasn't it all a longing to go back to the time when I had stood in his presence? But could you ever find him, I wondered as we crested a hill, by going backwards? The very nature of the person I had met was his now-ness. He was overwhelmingly and everywhere present, so that no other time could even exist where he was. It was no good, I suddenly saw, looking for him in the past, even when that past was only 15 months before. I knew that afternoon, on the road from Rethel, that if I wanted to feel the nearness of Christ, and I did want that, above everything else, I would have to find it in the people that he put before me each day. We had reached the chateau grounds as these thoughts went whirling through my head. We walked around in back, there was the tree stump on which I had sat, only a little over 2 weeks before, praying to be allowed to die. And all at once I knew something else, on this day of new insights. That prayer had been answered. In a sense in which I never meant it, I had indeed died. For the first time in many months I had put aside my self-pity, my self-incrimination, all thoughts of any kind about myself, long enough to get involved with someone else. Jack's injury and his healing had been the one thing on my mind those last 2 weeks. In caring for him I had lost sight of myself. And in losing myself, I had discovered Christ. It was strange, I thought, I had had to die, in Texas, too, to see him. I wondered if we always had to die, some stubborn part of us, before we could see more of him. Jack stayed only another week in the hospital before returning to his air base, but in that week we cemented a friendship that has lasted 30 years. Because he lives today in Malibu Beach, California, and I in Irvington, Virginia, we do not see each other often, but every visit picks up as though we had just strolled off a country road in France. That was the beginning, for me, that country walk. The moment when I began to integrate the near-death experience in Barkley, Texas, with all the rest of my life. The first step, I realized, was to stop trying to recapture that otherworldly vision of Jesus, and start looking for him in the faces across the mess table. That was not easy for a young soldier who had spent all his life in a small southern city. Roman Catholics, Jews, African Americans, I had grown up believing these people were not only different from me, but not as good. And so Jesus in his mercy had put me in the 123rd Evac. He let me start, too, that the greater healing was taking place in me. We talked about everything on those walks, school, childhood, careers, and all the time the feeling grew that I had known Jack Helms before. He was a deeply committed Christian, I learned, a Protestant, although he attended church with the Catholic family who had adopted him and shown him great kindness. And all at once one day, without intending to any more than I had intended talking to my stepmother, I found myself telling him about the night I had come out of a hospital movie theater and asked a ward boy for some aspirin. As they had been the earlier time, the words were simply there. I told him all of it, the ambulance ride to the X-ray section, waking up in a strange small room to find someone else in my bed, walking down a street in Vicksburg, Mississippi, trying to get a passerby to listen to me. It was the second time I had been able to talk about my experience. I could tell by the wonderment in Jack's face that he had never heard anything even remotely like what I was describing. I could also see by his expression that not for an instant did he doubt what I was saying. I described the light that had entered the little cubicle. How my whole life had somehow entered at the same time, lit up by a love such as I had never. I stopped, staring at Jack. That nagging feeling that I had known him before. That strange sense I had had the very first day of being in the presence of a familiar friend. It was Christ who all this time had been looking at me out of Jack Helms's eyes. The acceptance. The caring. The joy. Of course I recognized these things. I had encountered them in a hospital room in Texas, and now, 5,000 miles away, I had met them again on a hillside in France. They were echoes only, this time, imperfect, transmitted through a fallible human being. But at least I knew now from whom the message was coming. So much was falling into place as we turned around on the road and headed back toward camp. For once neither of us spoke. Jack did not press me to continue my interrupted story. He seemed in his perceptive way to know that I was working something out in my mind. The lonesomeness I had felt that year, the alienation from the world and the things that went on here, wasn't it all a longing to go back to the time when I had stood in his presence? But could you ever find him, I wondered as we crested a hill, by going backwards? The very nature of the person I had met was his nowness. He was overwhelmingly and everywhere present, so that no other time could even exist where he was. It was no good, I suddenly saw, looking for him in the past, even when that past was only 15 months before. I knew that afternoon, on the road from Rethel, that if I wanted to feel the nearness of Christ, and I did want that, above everything else, I would have to find it in the people that he put before me each day. We had reached the chateau grounds as these thoughts went whirling through my head. We walked around in back. There was the tree stump on which I had sat, only a little over 2 weeks before, praying to be allowed to die. And all at once I knew something else, on this day of new insights. That prayer had been answered. In a sense in which I never meant it, I had indeed died. For the first time in many months I had put aside my self-pity, my self-incrimination, all thoughts of any kind about myself, long enough to get involved with someone else. Jack's injury and his healing had been the one thing on my mind those last 2 weeks. In caring for him I had lost sight of myself. And in losing myself, I had discovered Christ. It was strange, I thought, I had had to die, in Texas, too, to see him. I wondered if we always had to die, some stubborn part of us, before we could see more of him. Jack stayed only another week in the hospital before returning to his air base, but in that week we cemented a friendship that has lasted 30 years. Because he lives today in Malibu Beach, California, and I in Irvington, Virginia, we do not see each other often, but every visit picks up as though we had just strolled off a country road in France. That was the beginning, for me, that country walk. The moment when I began to integrate the near-death experience in Barkley, Texas, with all the rest of my life. The first step, I realized, was to stop trying to recapture that otherworldly vision of Jesus, and start looking for him in the faces across the mess table. That was not easy for a young soldier who had spent all his life in a small southern city. Roman Catholics, Jews, African Americans, I had grown up believing these people were not only different from me, but not as good. And so Jesus in his mercy had put me in the 123rd Evac. He let me start with Jack because Jack was easy, you had to see the Christ in Jack. But before long I started seeing Jesus in a Jew from New York, an Italian from Chicago, an African American from Trenton. I discovered something else and at first it puzzled me. The more I learned to see Christ in other people, the less I was crushed by the death and suffering our unit dealt with. It seemed like it would be the opposite. The more you found to love in people, the harder it would be to see their pain. It never got easy, of course, but it became somehow bearable, and again I found myself thinking back to the Texas experience. I had been glamorizing that memory, I realized, dwelling only on the joy of his presence. But when I recalled it honestly, there had been much in that other realm that was frankly hideous, scenes of agony worse than anything even in the train wreck at Street Valerie. I had told myself I wanted to leave this earth because I had seen a better place. But that was not true. I began to realize, the afterworld I had glimpsed was both infinitely brighter than this one, and infinitely more savage and terrible. Why hadn't the evil side of that world crushed my spirit, as the negatives of this world had done? I had started reading the Bible, back in my tent, and one day I came to a psalm that seemed to help. If I ascend up into heaven, I read in Psalm 139:8, Thou art the, if I make my bed in Sheol, behold, Thou art the. Of course, that was the answer. Jesus had been there, in those scenes of Sheol. It was His light, His compassion in which I was seeing the awfulness, and that shed a ray of hope, even in hell. When the war in Europe ended in May 1945, the 123rd Evac entered Germany with the occupying troops. I was part of a group assigned to a concentration camp near Wuppertal, charged with getting medical help to the newly liberated prisoners, many of them Jews from Holland, France, and Eastern Europe. This was the most shattering experience I had yet had. I had been exposed many times by then to sudden death and injury, but to see the effects of slow starvation, to walk through those barracks where thousands of men had died a little bit at a time over a period of years, was a new kind of horror. For many it was an irreversible process. We lost scores each day in spite of all the medicine and food we could rush to them. Now I needed my new insight indeed. When the ugliness became too great to handle, I did what I had learned to do. I went from one end to the other of that barbed wire enclosure, looking into men's faces until I saw looking back at me the face of Christ. And that is how I came to know Wild Bill Cody. That was not his real name. His real name was seven unpronounceable syllables in Polish, but he had a long drooping handlebar mustache like pictures of the old Western hero, so the American soldiers called him Wild Bill. He was one of the inmates of the concentration camp, but obviously he had not been there long. His posture was erect, his eyes bright, his energy indefatigable. Since he was fluent in English, French, German and Russian, as well as Polish, he became a kind of unofficial camp translator. We came to him with all sorts of problems. The paperwork alone was staggering in attempting to relocate people whose families, even whole hometowns, might have disappeared. But though Wild Bill worked 15 and 16 hours a day, he showed no signs of weariness. While the rest of us were drooping with fatigue, he seemed to gain strength. We have time for this old fellow, he would say. He's been waiting to see us all day. His compassion for his fellow prisoners glowed on his face, and it was to this glow that I came when my own spirits were low. So I was astonished to learn, when Wild Bill's own papers came before us one day, that he had been in Wuppertal since 1939. For 6 years he had lived on the same starvation diet, slept in the same airless and disease-ridden barracks as everyone else, but without the least physical or mental deterioration. Perhaps even more amazing, every group in the camp looked on him as a friend. He was the one to whom quarrels between inmates were brought for arbitration. Only after I had been at Wuppertal a number of weeks did I realize what a rarity this was in a compound where the different nationalities of prisoners hated each other almost as much as they did the Germans. As for Germans, feeling against them ran so high that in some of the camps liberated earlier, former prisoners had seized guns, run into the nearest village and simply shot the first Germans they saw. Part of our instructions were to prevent this kind of thing, and again Wild Bill was our greatest asset, reasoning with the different groups, counseling forgiveness. It's not easy for some of them to forgive, I commented to him one day as we sat over mugs of tea in the processing center. So many of them have lost members of their families. With Jack, because Jack was easy, you had to see the Christ in Jack. But before long I started seeing Jesus in a Jew from New York, an Italian from Chicago, an African American from Trenton. I discovered something else and at first it puzzled me. The more I learned to see Christ in other people, the less I was crushed by the death and suffering our unit dealt with. It seemed like it would be the opposite. The more you found to love in people, the harder it would be to see their pain. It never got easy, of course, but it became somehow bearable, and again I found myself thinking back to the Texas experience. I had been glamorizing that memory, I realized, dwelling only on the joy of his presence. But when I recalled it honestly, there had been much in that other realm that was frankly hideous, scenes of agony worse than anything even in the train wreck at Street Valerie. I had told myself I wanted to leave this earth because I had seen a better place,